Amina is an activist during the Arab Spring. Her blog, Gay Girl in Damascus, attracts readers from around the world. When she's mysteriously abducted, her followers mobilize, desperate to save her. What they find shocks them. I'm Samira Moyeddin, the host of Gay Girl Gone, a new 6-part series from CBC. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
What is that? That, it turns out, is a very rare sound. It is the call of the North Atlantic right whale. These whales are one of the most endangered mammals on the planet. Scientists believe there are only about 340 right whales still alive. Many of them spend their time off the coast of New Brunswick and Nova Scotia or in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. Delphine Durette-Morin is a researcher hoping to better protect the species, and to do that, she is using sound recordings like the one we just heard of the whales as they travel. She's here in Halifax. Delphine, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
I want to talk about what you're doing and how and why you're doing it, but can you just talk about the whales first? And I ask this as somebody who, this is your, you know, what you do for a living, but there is something magical and wondrous about seeing whales. I just wonder what the first time was like for you when you saw a North Atlantic right whale. Do you remember that?
I do, yeah. The first time I saw a right whale was on a plane on an aerial survey in 2015 when we were first exploring the Gulf of St. Lawrence with the NOAA team. And I was very new. I had only seen, you know, humpbacks and the more generic whale, even though they're all important. And sure enough, we went out there and we saw a right whale. And at first my eyes had to adjust because right whales are a bit different looking. They're a bit bulkier and they have these callosities on their heads that kind of tricks your brain when you first see them. I had the stereotypical shivers, and just being in awe of just seeing how big the animal was. So I had the opportunity to see it from the air. So I just got to appreciate how big of an animal it really is.
How big is it?
That is a good question. They're, I would say between 40 and 60 feet.
Big. Like, I mean, big enough that you, whale researcher, would say that it's a big
animal. Yeah, it's big. Usually when we're on vessels, we're sometimes on crab vessels, so they're 60-foot vessels, and they'll come up next to us, and they make up a good portion of the length of the boat.
Wow.
You get a good appreciation for how big they are. Even when you see little calves, they're the size of a minke whale. They're, you know, between 15 and 20 feet. I mean, that's a baby, which is insane that they're so large.
You said you got the stereotypical shivers.
Yeah, I think that's a stereotypical, just the awe and amazement of like, wow, this is, you know, an amazing giant of the ocean that you don't necessarily get to see what they see. We get to see just to witness a portion of their life when they're at the surface. So they're very mysterious and mystical beings in my head.
Why are there so few of them?
Unfortunately, whales were targeted for whale hunting, and right whales were the right whales to kill. So that's how they got their name. They float easily and they're very coastal, and so they were the easy targets for whalers. And they were heavily hunted from, you know, very early on. The earliest record, I think, are from the Basque whale hunting, and that continued on, and that really devastated that population. It also devastated other whale populations, but this population specifically was the first one that was targeted because it was such an easy target.
That's where the name comes from? They're the right whale to kill.
Yeah, they were the right whale to kill, which isn't the best way of remembering them, but unfortunately that is how they got their name. Yeah.
So when I said there's 340 whales still alive, is that Is that a static number? Is that number declining? Is it increasing?
Unfortunately, it's been decreasing. And that is a modeled number. So the number is based on the North Atlantic right whale catalog from the consortium that's held by the New England Aquarium. And the right whale is a really interesting species because we can identify them with the patterns of callosity on their heads. They're like fingerprints. You get to be able to identify them on the individual basis. And because it's been so extensively studied for so many years, we get to have the opportunity to know, okay, which are the individuals that make up the population? And how often are they photographed? And, you know, once a whale either is deceased or it hasn't been resighted in 9-10 years, then it's potentially a deceased whale. And with that fluctuation from year to year, we get to insert that into statistical models that give us a likely population size number.
You're talking about the callosities, identifying them. I'm just looking at a picture of that. Like, just explain what that is for people who don't know.
Sure. So they're rugged patches of skin on, they're almost like rocks, on top of their rostrum, which is the top of their heads. And they actually, if we go more into details, they actually have these little cyamids, which are little crustaceans. They're like mini crabs, let's say. And they're white, and they live on this rugged part of skin that is on top of their heads. And from a boat or from a plane, because of the rugged patches on the different individual whales will have different shapes. Mm. So sometimes they'll have a continuous shape from the top of the head to the tip of the head. And sometimes they'll have broken shapes or little islands. And that will help us with the use of photo identification. So when we take a good photo from different angles, you're able to draw the heads of these whales. And because each whale has a different pattern on their head, you can identify the individual.
That is so interesting.
Yeah, it's a big component of the science, the what science is possible to perform and the different analyses in the species. For example, because we can identify the different individuals, we can track, when I say we, I mean the royal we. There's a lot of people working on these problems. But scientists can identify progression of scarring, which gives us information on whether the whale has been entangled before or not, and so on and so forth. So we get to track these life histories on an individual basis, which can provide a lot of very interesting and compelling data for numerous things, including conservation.
You mentioned the numbers are declining. What's the biggest threat that they face now?
The two biggest threats, unfortunately, are human-caused. It's entanglements in fishing gear and ship strikes.
And so in somewhere like the Gulf of St. Lawrence, which is a pretty busy patch of water, or can be, mm-hmm. What are the regulations that are in place to protect them?
There's two different categories of regulations in the Gulf of St. Lawrence right now since 2017. Which was onset by the unprecedented mortality crisis in those waters when we found at least 12 dead right whales that year. So the two categories are fishing management and then shipping management. With fishing, there's regulations where when a right whale is sighted in an area, the fishing area grids are closed for 15 days after the right whale is sighted. So fishermen have to go and extract their fishing gear and leave it out of the water in those areas for the 15 days. That's the gist of it. And then the regulations on the shipping side of things is very similar. There's some areas in the Gulf, especially near and around Shediac Valley, which is a bit east of Beta Schiller. Mm-hmm. It's where a lot of the whales have been sighted and have been aggregating. And there's a static area where ships have to slow down. And so they can't go higher than 8 or 10 knots. And in the shipping lanes, because in the Gulf, the Gulf is actually a huge area.
Yeah.
It's a really big body of water, but it includes shipping lanes, really important shipping lanes that, you know, fuel a lot of our shipping into the middle of the country. And in these shipping lanes, they're divided into two sections. There's a section that has mandatory slowdown measures. So when a whale is detected, either visually or acoustically, we can talk about that more in a bit, but when a whale is detected, the vessels have to go a certain speed, which reduces the likelihood of a lethal strike if they hit a whale, or it gives them a higher chance of sighting a whale, so then they can, go a different direction. The other section in the Gulf is the Cabot Strait. And the Cabot Strait is a voluntary slowdown measure in the spring and then in the fall.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
And again, as you've been saying, part of this is knowing where the whales are. And so there's visual identification, flying in the plane or what have you, seeing mm-hmm. them from the water. But then there is a way of identifying where they are through the sounds that they make. And you use sound recordings to try to help us better understand where those whales might be. I want to play some of this
sure.
because it's radio and people can listen in as well. Kind of stood up. What is that?
That's a North Atlantic right whale. Some up calls, which are very important calls for the detection of the species, especially with respect to protection measures. The up calls are produced by all sex classes, all age classes, and it's used like a contact call just to communicate with their buddies.
Okay, let me play you something else. Mm-hmm. What's that?
That sounds like what could be a humpback upsweeps.
It's like stump the band here, where I'm kind of just playing things and then asking you what the song is, but no, you actually know what that is.
It's like the trial. I feel like I'm on my defense, my master's defense again or something. I wish they had quizzed me on that. That would have been fun. So humpbacks are an example of a species that can be problematic because for the identification of or the detection of right whales, because they do have an overlapping sound repertoire. And what that means is they produce sounds that can be similar to what other species characteristically produce. And one thing that we do to counteract that problem is humpbacks often will produce songs. That's what they're known for, right? If you can notice that there's a pattern, then hands down, you're like, nope, that's not a right whale, that's a humpback. So you're safe, you're clear, you mark that as a humpback and not a right whale. And so it's a lot of different things that you have to put in consideration when you're analyzing these acoustic recordings to make sure that you're identifying the species correctly.
I mean, that's just incredible. You listen to that. It sounds like they're talking to each other. I want to play you one more thing. These are right whales again, but they make sounds other than what we heard earlier.
Sounds like screams, which are thought to be produced by female right whales. And gunshot, which are a crazy sound that these whales produce.
So that was actually a whale sound, not an actual gunshot.
No, yeah, that was the little, it's actually much louder normally. Like when I listen to acoustics, I have to be careful to not press play when my speakers are, or my headphones are on full volume, because the upcall is just so loud. It's a broadband sound in all frequencies. But right whales produce these gunshots that, they're called gunshots. And they're thought, to be produced by males during reproductive behaviors or competitive behaviors. But one thing that's really cool about the gunshot, actually, that when you observe the whales, there's an interesting thing that happens when they're producing, when we think they're producing gunshots, is they'll kind of reverberate. Like we call it jello. Like they look like they're made of jello. Like you can see the waves going through their blubber, which is so wild to see. It's really cool. Yeah, so that's the gunshot.
That sounds amazing.
It is. It's really neat to see. And we don't see that often. You have to pay really close attention to be able to notice that. And you have to be on a vessel and be close to the whale, of course. But yeah, it's a pretty special thing to see.
So if you listen to what we have been hearing and the sounds that you're analyzing, how can that and that data that has been collected and analyzed better protect these whales in those areas where they may be vulnerable?
Mm-hmm. There's kind of two parts to that question. The first is having an idea of the distribution of an animal is really important, especially to know where this distribution might overlap with potential threats. And gathering that data over a large area is really challenging because of limited resources. You know, you can't have eyes on the water everywhere all the time. Also, the Atlantic water, you know, Atlantic Canada isn't well known for consistent, wonderful weather. And so it's really challenging to acquire that large amount of data. And a nice thing about acoustics is that we can have a recorder underwater continuously recording, continuously listening, and we can slowly accumulate that data so that we have this big picture, which is really important, especially to then measure if in future years, you know, we talk a lot about climate change and how it affects the ecosystems, and that can have, you know, bottom up or cascade down effects on the ecosystems and predators and things like that. And it shifts their distribution because they want to follow their food. If in the future, if these shifts continue to happen, having a broad scale idea of species distribution is really important to then be able to compare and be like, oh yes, there has been a shift in this distribution. The whales are now in a different water that may not be protected. So this broad scale data that these acoustic recorders can provide is really important. The other aspect is a more dynamic aspect. There's technology that allows us to communicate these detections in real time or near real time. And so you can have a recorder or hydrophone, it's an underwater microphone, on things like underwater gliders. So they're autonomous vehicles that can profile or navigate the water continuously. And this, every time they go back to the surface, they have onboard computers and auto detectors that can ping us back the data and be like, hey, you know what? The likelihood of a right whale being detected here with the sounds that I just heard, it's pretty likely. Mm. And so I think there's a right whale here. And of course, this data is all validated and things like that with following protocols. But this is really important to protect the whale, to protect or restrict human activities or lessen human activity risk in areas where the whales currently are in an active manner.
As you said, I mean, St. Lawrence in particular is an important passage into the heart of the country. There are commercial interests that are at play on those waters. Do you have support, do you think, from those commercial shipping companies to modulate their behavior to better protect these whales?
I think there has been unprecedented efforts in Canada thus far, and it's been really great to see. I think there's still a lot of work that can be done, and we work hard to educate and to provide stewardship or increase stewardship for these whales in these areas. The problem is there's a lot of turnover in the operators that use these waters. And so we continuously have to educate new operators because they may not have been the ones using the waters the week or the month before. And so it's a continuous effort that has to happen. So there's still a lot of work to be done. Mm. But like you mentioned, these shipping lanes are really important. And then you have the Cabot Strait.
Right.
That's actually, it's basically a bottleneck for right whales and other whales and then large ships because it's the only way in and out of the Gulf St. Lawrence. So it's really important to manage these areas correctly and effectively, especially since the whales could be really difficult to detect in areas like that when they're traveling.
Well, and if we don't? I mean, what is the timeline? With 340 whales, extinction seems like a real possibility.
It is, unfortunately, yeah. We remain hopeful, but the facts are that there's, you know, the population is really low. And of those 340 individuals, there's about 70 to 100 reproductive females. And so those 70 females at the mortality or the human-induced mortality rates that we've seen in the last 5 years... If we continue that way, then within 20 to 30 years, the population would be at least functionally extinct. So that means there's no reproductive females in the population. And so we wouldn't be able to see a population growth. In that sense, that's the reality of it and the facts. But, you know, there's a lot of people working on this problem. And it's like I said, it's unprecedented efforts. Like, you don't see this kind of effort and this kind of work anywhere else in the world for any other species. And so it's really encouraging to see. And the operators in the fishing industry, the shipping industry and the fishing industry, they don't want to harm the whales. Yeah. They don't want that public image or just, you know, that abuse of the ocean either. And so we're working really hard to try to find solutions or evidence-based solutions with these industries so that we could better mitigate and protect the whales.
This is fascinating work, and I'm really, really glad to have the chance to talk to you about it. Delphin, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Were you always just going to go into this industry, by the way, given your name? I mean, people have names for all sorts of things. Delphin's like dolphin. Like, so it was inevitable that you'd be doing this work?
Yeah, I guess it was a pre-prescribed fate for me, which I'm more than happy to fulfill.
Delightful.
Yeah.
Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Delphin Durette-Morin is an assistant scientist with the Canadian Whale Institute, and she's based here in Halifax.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.